welcome to News in Focus with your host, Chris Long, president of the Ohio Christian Alliance. Stay tuned for an analysis and conversation about the issues that matter most to you and your family. Here now with this week's edition of News in Focus is Chris Long.
And good afternoon and welcome to this edition of News in Focus. We're glad that you're with us. Happy New Year to you and your family as we enter into 2018, which will be an eventful year politically as the midterms later this year will unfold and the political landscape is being set. When we came out of December, of course, there was a major victory for the president with the passage of tax reform, the first major tax reform legislation in 30 years that came out of Washington, as Congress finally aligned together with the president and was able to pass a major tax reform legislation, which by all accounts is going to pay dividends for the economy moving forward. The stock market has responded and in kind and is continuing to keep its momentum going forward. But in addition to that, we have international challenges around the world as Iran protest of university students continues day after day. And then looking to North Korea, of course, which we are seeing challenges there with the North Korean regime. And that's what we're going to talk about this first half hour with our good friend Fred Flights, who's with the Center for Security Policy with Frank Gaffney in Washington, D.C., a national security think tank. And Fred has been doing some research over the years. He used to work with John Bolton, who was the Undersecretary of State for the, Arms Control and International Security when he worked for Mr. Bolton at the UN. Fred, welcome to the program.
Hey, Chris, good to be here. Happy New Year.
A happy New Year to you as well. And, of course, as we look to the world scene, next month in February will be the Winter Olympics, which isn't getting much press, actually, or promotion, which is kind of interesting in and of itself. It's going to be in South Korea, and obviously it's going to be the world stage as far as the Winter Olympics goes, but just north of the border, therein lies the problem with North Korea. Explain.
Well, the Olympics will be held in a city just 30 miles from the border and within the range of a huge arsenal of missiles and chemical weapons and artillery, biological weapons, and possibly nuclear weapons. So it's a concern. But you know, my view is that the Olympics have to go on. The United States has to attend. We can't allow the North Koreans to intimidate us, to abandon an event that is so important to one of our closest allies, South Korea. Now, there's word that the North Koreans may be attending the Olympics. That's a good thing. The purpose of the Olympics is to bring nations together. We got a lot of problems with North Koreans. We got a lot of problems with negotiating. But look, if they send a delegation, it means tensions will be reduced, and I think that's a good thing.
Well, in the last 24 hours, of course, you've seen this exchange between President Trump and Kim Jong-un as to who has the bigger nuclear button. As Kim Jong-un was saying, I now have a nuclear button on my desk. And President Trump tweeted, I have a bigger nuclear button on my desk. What's your thoughts when you see that exchange, Fred?
Well, I think the president has sent another very critical tweet, especially on Iran recently. I'm not really a fan of his tweeting, and I didn't think this tweet was particularly productive. But I will add that these threats from North Korea are getting tiresome. And this is not the first time the North Koreans have threatened to attack the United States with nuclear weapons. And from that perspective, I think the president is sending a message to Kim Jong-un, knock it off. It's not the approach I would have taken, but I understand what he was getting at.
Well, that's right. I mean, he has a style all his own, the president does, and it's very interesting, actually, to watch his leadership. There's times in which he can appear very statesmanlike, where we've seen him on numerous occasions when he's taken foreign trips actually just hit it out of the park. I mean, when he went to the Middle East, to Saudi Arabia, to Riyadh, and spoke to the principal nations of the Middle East and gave, I thought, an exceptional speech. And then he visited Israel and then to Rome, to Europe. And obviously that was his first foreign ministry trip. And then, of course, he's gone to the Far East. And again, conducted himself very statesmanlike. It's when he's basically sitting at home and he gets in the Twitter war. He's obviously used social media to his advantage as a politician. He's carried that over into the White House. Obviously, we'll be writing books about this for some time to come as to how that is. It's just so different than what we've ever seen in the past.
Well, what many of my colleagues say, Trump will be Trump. This is the way this man is. It's the way he thinks. And I reiterate, I think the tweets he sent concerning the protests in Iran and the United States standing up for freedom and calling out the Iranian regime, this is what an American president should be doing. And it puts the Europeans who have been silent about this to shame. So we can be critical about the president's tweets, and I have been, but his tweets on Iran have been right on the money.
Well, and like you said, when it comes to North Korea and Kim Jong-un, certainly, you know, he's the one that's doing all the saber rattling. And he expects in past administrations, they either ignore him or they don't say much, and he gets away with it. With Trump, he's a brawler. He'll take his jacket off, says, "You want to mix it up with me? Come on." And he has that kind of attitude towards it. But he tends to call people's bluffs as well. And, you know, of course, just before all this transpired during the holidays was a report where there is supposed to be strict sanctions on North Korea, in which the UN and principal nations are to participate. But here we see China cheating in the satellite images that show gas and oil being transported to North Korea. Your thoughts?
Well, let's first deal with an argument that the left is making, that Trump's policies is making the situation worse. Bear in mind that North Korea had 4 of its 6 nuclear tests on Obama's watch. Its nuclear program, its missile program, surged to enormous levels during the Obama policy of strategic patience, a policy to do nothing. So basically, President Trump has handed a disaster, and I think he is responding. Basically, he's making the case that doing nothing is not an option. So I think that we see a constructive policy here, and we see a realization by an American president who's come to the conclusion that North Korea's nuclear and missile arsenal can't be written off as a deterrent any longer. North Korea may have 60 nuclear weapons, ICBMs that could hit anywhere in the United States. This is not a defensive program to prevent a U.S. attack. This is an offensive program that the North one day probably will use to unite the Korean Peninsula on its terms and drive the United States from the Asia-Pacific. That's why this president can't kick this down the road again.
You're saying 60 nuclear warheads, ICBMs? How is that being determined, whether that's factual or not?
That is the latest estimate by the U.S. intelligence community. It came out over the summer. I got to tell you, I'm skeptical whether the North Koreans can actually miniaturize a nuclear device to fit on a missile. I don't think they can yet. However, there are many experts who think they can. My belief is that we have to prepare for the worst-case scenario, that the North has mastered this technology, or maybe that North Korea plans to use its nuclear weapons as electromagnetic pulse weapons that would be easier to use to attack the United States to destroy the U.S. power grid, because a reentry vehicle is not required. That is a vehicle to prevent the warhead from burning up after it enters the atmosphere. So there's a lot of very dangerous scenarios here, and I don't think we should rule out the worst possible scenarios.
One of the things that was discussed this last summer when all this was unfolding was our capability to be able to shoot down an ICBM with lasers. Now, it seems as if that has to happen before it enters the orbit. What is the thought there? Because once it enters orbit, we're not able to do anything with it. Is that true? Or once it reaches a certain cycle in its launch, that you can't get it on upon reentry. What are our capabilities to protect the United States, continental United States, from a nuclear attack?
Well, the best system we have is a boost phase system. That is, when the missile is taking off and it's moving slower. There are some systems to hit the rocket at other stages, including on its descent. It's much harder to do that. But the issue here that people are talking about is that our systems to take out the North Korean nuclear program, most of them were canceled by the Obama administration. Now, the Obama administration actually restarted some of them, but they're still years behind. And that means I don't think we have an operable laser system right now. And the main reason for that is because it was shut down by President Obama.
Now, President Trump has given the military a green light to go forward, obviously the Pentagon. There's still a lot of Obama holdovers within the Pentagon. He's given the generals the green light in the Middle East. That's why we've seen much more success against ISIS. We're seeing ground gained again in Afghanistan, and positive things are happening on the ground because the military's rules of engagement and basically leadership from the top, by all estimations of what military leadership are saying, that what's coming out of the White House is not a conflicting message, and it's very clear, and it's helping us to achieve and accomplish our mission goals. Your thoughts on that?
That's my position, too. I think the president has made some good choices for his military strategy. And you may remember during the Obama years that drone strikes were being micromanaged by the White House. You know, this really has to be left to experts in the field. We don't need the president or his staff of former Democratic campaign assistants like Ben Rhodes choosing what we hit with a drone. It has to be done by the military, and I think the president has made the right decisions, and it's really paid off.
Well, that's right. And obviously, the military is encouraged by that. They're able to effectively do their mission. So we would like to see that continued. We're obviously seeing ISIS in full retreat in Syria and Iraq. Basically, they've been eliminated from Iraq. There's just vestiges of them, pockets of them here and there. We've seen where they're now starting to pick up personnel that have been left behind in Mosul. There was one individual who was known as the executioner that was arrested the other day. So they've been hiding out because basically as a terror army, they no longer exist in Iraq, and they're in full retreat. So congratulations to the multinational force that's been working, and again, the U.S. policy that's not conflicted, not confusing, and not sending mixed signals as it was during the Obama administration, which was a disaster. And it basically emboldened our enemies and discouraged our allies. And so it's great to see the change of course that's taken place in Washington with this administration. But going back to the Korean Peninsula, obviously the Winter Games are in February. You are of the opinion that, and here the South Korea responded to Kim's remarks on Tuesday, calling for a dialogue between Seoul and Pyongyang aimed at de-escalating tensions ahead of the Winter Games. So there looks as if they're extending an olive branch out to Kim Jong-un to restart some kind of dialogue. Your thoughts on that?
I'm concerned about that because South Korean President Moon is a bit of a leftist. He said when he ran for president, he would meet with North Korean leader Kim before he met with President Trump. Now, that didn't happen, but this guy is too interested in striking some kind of a deal with North Korea, and the North Koreans count on that. They count on their bad behavior to extract concessions from the United States, from South Korea, and from Japan. So the talks may be a positive development to a point, but we can't let them let the pressure off the North concerning the threats from its nuclear missile program.
Back to China's role, because obviously China is obviously influential in North Korea. Here, by satellite images that were released over the holidays, it looked as if they were violating the sanctions policy by providing oil and gas to North Korea. You know, that doesn't help. They say one thing at the table and then do another. So it doesn't
Can I get back to that point? You raised it earlier and didn't respond to it. That is the satellite imagery of oil transfers to North Korea. And I'm sorry, I forgot to mention that. The good news is, I think there's solid intelligence that the Chinese have begun to crack down and enforce security council resolutions. This began in September. This imagery was from October. It could be that China's really cheating, or it could be that it's going to take time for China to fully comply with the sanctions. I thought it was very promising that after China started cracking down in September, it agreed to an even tougher resolution in December. So, you know, in my mind, I'm prepared to give the Chinese the benefit of the doubt. And the information, the satellite imagery, did not come from the U.S. government. So, you know, it could be that they're cheating. They have a record of cheating. But my hope is they're so worried about North Korea, they actually are cracking down.
I see. And they're obviously a very, you know, the president has said so, that they're a key member in this negotiation. They can apply the greatest amount of pressure on North Korea to fall into line. How much influence does China have? I mean, are we dealing with truly an independent rogue state with North Korea that is willing to go it alone? Or is China the major player and influence upon North Korea for what they do as far as military and or policy?
China does not have as much influence on the North that it would like to have. However, its oil exports to the North are crucial for the North's economy. Now, North Korea has stockpiled oil because they're worried that there could be a cutoff. And I think the day is coming before we consider the use of military force against North Korea that we should get together with the Chinese and say, can you remove the Kim regime and replace it with something that we can both live with? Because I got to tell you, I think the North Koreans setting off hydrogen bombs near the Chinese border is something the Chinese would like to stop.
Well, that's right. We're talking with Fred Flights, who is Senior Vice President at the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C. We're talking about the Korean situation and obviously how this might affect us going forward. Now, the Winter Games are in February. There's been an invitation extended to the North to participate. Will they? Fred?
You know, I don't know. I sort of think that North Korea might do that because it is concerned that tensions have reached too high a point and this could lower them, and maybe it could use this to extract concessions from South Korea. And, you know, there have been some calls by people in the U.S. that we should boycott as the North Koreans go. I think that's really silly. The North Koreans might send three athletes. But I think it's a good thing as long as we keep it in perspective.
And you're saying that the Winter Games are literally just 30 miles from the DMZ?
Correct. Well, both Koreas are small countries.
Yeah, that's incredible. What kind of winter? Obviously, we're in the middle of a deep freeze here in the U.S. right now. I think last week the average temperature was 11 degrees in the lower 48. What kind of winter are they having there in Korea?
I don't know, but I've been in Seoul, and the winter was pretty cold. My dad was in the Korean War, and I have pictures of him, and it looked cold. So I suspect that they'll get lots of snow.
Well, because I'd seen a report where there had been some of the Northern Army was allowed leave to go scavenge for food. You know, we get these reports of how just how bad things are in the North, and what they have as far as for fuel, for heating, and for just the basics of life. And there was this report that sections of the Army were given leave over the holidays just to scavenge for food. How reliable are those reports? Are they accurate? What's the truth?
I just don't think we know. The information out of North Korea is so tightly controlled. There's a lot of disinformation, a lot of rumor. It wouldn't surprise me if that's the case. But frankly, this is a country that is not connected to the internet. Well, I should say there's a very small trusted elite that is, but the North Korean people is not.
Before we let you go, Fred, what is your thoughts of the protests that are taking place in Iran? Obviously, during the Obama administration, there were similar protests, but Washington and President Obama remained silent. They didn't do any encouragement whatsoever. Conversely, President Trump has tweeted encouragement to the students who are protesting against the regime. He's applauded their efforts and encouraged them on to democracy. Obviously, we've seen some response from other leaders, but by and large, like you said, Europe has been silent on the issue, the European leadership. Why is that?
Well, I think that the foreign policy elite in the U.S. and in Europe bet the farm on the Iranian mullahs on this nuclear deal, and they don't want to admit that they were wrong, that this deal was supposed to bring Iran into the community of nations and end hostility. Iran's behavior got worse after this deal. But something people aren't talking about, you know, the billions of dollars in sanctions relief that Iran received from this deal was not used to help the ordinary Iranian. It was used to build weapons. It was used to build missiles. Did you know that Iran gave $800 million to Hezbollah, its terrorist proxy, last year? Oh. Iran also has given Syria a $1 billion line of credit. Meanwhile, ordinary Iranians can't buy eggs or chicken, and some of them are selling their organs, selling their kidneys to raise money. That's what this is about. That's what this protest is about.
Wow. Well, we certainly are praying for those folks that are protesting and are seeking freedom from the tyrannical regime, obviously a terrorist state that sponsored terrorism around the world against the United States' interests and against Israel, of course. And we're going to have you back on just to focus on Iran and the Middle East. With us this half hour, my guest has been Fred Flight, Senior Vice President for Policy and Programs at the Center for Security Policy. And if you'd like to learn more of their organization, that's the Center for Security Policy.org in Washington, D.C. Fred, thanks for coming on today.
Good to be here.
Thank you. God bless. If you missed any of this program, you can always visit us at our website at ohioca.org and hear the full interview in its entirety. Again, also some of our programs are available, and the issues that we're working on at the Ohio Christian Alliance are available at our website at ohioca.org. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after the break with Nathan Colasio to talk about the Iraqi Christians and what is happening in Iraq today.
Who's looking out for seniors today? It's not the AARP. AARP worked overtime to help pass Obamacare, the legislation that cut over $700 billion from Medicare. And AARP supports the death tax, which can rob families of over half their savings due to the death of a loved one. Seniors know that AARP would rather make millions peddling insurance products than support the policies that actually help America's elderly. That's why America's seniors count on the 60 Plus Association. For more than 20 years, 60 Plus has been fighting for the seniors that AARP has left behind. 60 Plus Plus fought against Obamacare and continues to fight every day for its repeal in Washington. And 60 Plus is the leading national organization working to repeal the death tax once and for all so that families can pass down their businesses and farms to the next generation, not the IRS. Stand up for your values. Join 60 Plus today. Visit 60plus.org or call 703-807-2070. This message paid for and authorized by the 60 Plus Association.
I'm Johnette Cruz, and I'm a busy mom. Then a friend told me about TrustBlueReview.com, a new website powered by the Christian Blue Network. She uses it to find trusted Christian-owned businesses. I checked it out, read the helpful reviews, and found a great family dentist. Now I use TrustBlueReview for all my family's needs. For peace of mind, do what I did. Visit TrustBlueReview.com or download their free mobile app from your app store today.
The trusted source for all you do, TrustBlueReview.
Will my kids like this dentist? Can I trust this mechanic? Who's a good choice for my upcoming remodel? I found businesses I can trust from TrustBlueReview.com.
This company rebuilt our deck and renovated our bathroom. I'd highly recommend them to anyone looking to hire an honest contractor.
The best dentist experience I've ever had.
It's now easy to find trusted businesses in my community that have the same Christian values as my family. It all starts at TrustBlueReview.com or download their app in the App Store today.
The trusted source for all you do. Trust Blue Review.
Okay, and we're back, and with us on the phone is Nathan Colosio, and we're going to talk about what's happening in Iraq today. Those of you that have listened to this program over the years, you know in the last few years, we have covered extensively during the 2014 invasion of the ISIS army into northern Iraq, and of course, the invading and pillaging of Christian communities in and around Mosul and other villages in northern Iraq. Thankfully, ISIS has been pushed out of Iraq for the most part, and that ISIS terror army is in full retreat, both in Syria and in Iraq. But in the wake of that, leaves a political conundrum, as there are various players that are vying for position in the region. We're also going to find out today what exactly is the status of the Iraqi Christians who found themselves in refugee camps in the Kurdish territories during that time in which ISIS had invaded and occupied Mosul. With me on the phone is our good friend Nathan Colosio from the greater Detroit area. And Nathan, it's great to have you back on the program, my friend.
Chris, Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. Thanks for having me on.
Merry Christmas to you as well, my friend. Well, listen, obviously, there's been a lot that's gone on in Iraq, and in fact, it's circling back. I was listening to an interview this morning of a congressional delegation that just came back stateside that over the holidays, they were actually visiting the various multinational forces on the ground in Iraq and talking to the people in Iraq. And from the congressman's perspective, what this will allow is to give the people of Iraq, and of course the government of Iraq, another opportunity. Obviously, after the Iraq war, there's a lot can be debated as to how that could have continued and pursued, but it did not. And in that vacuum, of course, came the ISIS army, terror army, into northern Iraq, wreaking havoc and committing genocide against minority faiths in the region, which we have covered on this program. And, of course, you were intimately acquainted with, as your contacts in Iraq were giving you firsthand information as to what was taking place. What is the status of those displaced Iraqi Christians who made their way to Erbil and other places in Kurdistan? Have they begun to migrate back to their homelands, or are they still in somewhat limbo because some of them want to migrate to the United States or to other European states? Your thoughts?
Well, for the most part, they've started to resettle back into the villages that have been liberated. Estimates are anywhere between 60-70% of those who were forced to flee have made it back home. The issue, of course, is that remaining 30%. And of course, those that fled the country as a whole. And so, it's going to be extremely difficult to get refugees who have fled into
nearby countries like Jordan and Turkey to go back to Iraq. And so, but for the most part, those that fled the Nineveh Plain villages, the estimates are about 60 to 70% have returned, which is around 40 to 45,000 people. The majority of our community still resides in the Erbil area and just outside of Erbil in a city called Ankawa, which is about 95% Christian town.
What was the name of that town again?
Ankawa, A-N-K-A-W-A.
And how many are there?
Estimates there are around 60,000, 60 to 70,000.
So an additional 60,000. How many actually had to evacuate the Mosul, greater Mosul area when ISIS came in at the time? Because we're looking here at numbers of 35 and 40,000, another 60,000.
About 150,000 total Christians were forced to flee in Mosul and the greater Nineveh Plains area, and the majority of whom ended up in Erbil, but like I said, several left the country altogether, mainly to Turkey or Jordan. Some have ended up in places like Beirut, Lebanon, of course, and others are in limbo in places like Syria.
Now, during the later end of the Obama administration, and I know that you worked with, and we asked Senator Portman and other members of the Senate to encourage the administration, the Obama administration, that is, to set up a visa processing center in Erbil. At that time, it was normally in the embassy in Baghdad, but it was untenable for these folks to make a passage or trip down to Baghdad, because they would be going through ISIS-controlled territory, and so they would be risking life and limb to do that. So the urgency was that in Erbil that they would set up a visa processing center. That happened in the last few years of about a year and a half of the Obama administration. How many were able to access that and take advantage of that?
Well, the processing itself takes a number of years. So the visa processing center got opened in 2015, and it was immediately flooded with those that were applying under refugee status. So we still have not yet seen high resettlement numbers of Iraqis. That's partly due to the initial moratorium on refugees earlier this year, and also partly due to Iraq being on the first travel ban list. But now that they've been taken off, we're hoping that we can get some of these visas expedited for the most vulnerable people there, which, of course, would be the Christian minority.
Okay, so Iraq has been taken off the travel ban list as of now. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. So that obviously that helps in those who would seek refugee or immigration to the United States who have family here and extended community, obviously, in Greater Detroit. What would you estimate the number of Chaldean Christian community to be in Greater Detroit?
I'm sorry, what was that?
What would you estimate the Chaldean Christian community to be in Greater Detroit?
Oh, we're approximately 150 to 160,000 at this point.
So, you know, as we've been talking, and I've been talking to some folks over the last year, and of course, we've made some friends with some Kurdish contacts as well. Obviously, President Barzani at the time was very accommodating to receiving the refugees when the crisis was emerging and when it was unfolding, taking in something like 3.5 million refugees, not just from northern Iraq and not just Chaldean Christians, but also Sunni and the other folks from Syria also coming in. So Yazidis, of course, into his territory for safety. What would you estimate the refugee population to still be in Kurdistan? That some of it might be still in camps there.
Yeah, there are several that are still in camps, in particular the Yazidis that are on the northwest part of the KRG area. But like you said, I mean, millions
were forced to flee into that area and still reside in camps. I'd anticipate still upwards about 2 million people. Whether they're still displaced in camps or appropriately resettled, there are still several refugees in that area. Barzani was hoping to make a big splash. The family and the leading party there, in particular, with a referendum for independence. But as we know, that's fallen short. And so, in addition to sort of these guerrilla style attacks with these lone wolves of ISIS, there's a lot of instability and you know what's going to happen between Baghdad and Erbil. And so, you know, Christians are very much still very vulnerable in that area. And we're hoping that this do-over, you know, this post-ISIS do-over, similar to the post-Al-Qaeda setup, will prove to be much more effective this time around.
Well, that's right. And this is our hope and our prayer. Now, let me ask a couple of questions. Now, obviously, the Kurds saw an opportunity as well. And obviously, everybody has, you know, some angle and political angle in which they're trying to seek advantage in favor of. Nothing's new under the sun, as they say, from Solomon. It was the same after World War II in the closing days of World War II, who was going to get what and this kind of thing. So it is with the retreat of the ISIS terror army, and in the wake of it, who will seek the advantage in northern Iraq? Now, the Kurds, arguably, are the largest people group on the planet without a known country. They don't have an actual country with boundaries. That's because the Kurds, by way of ethnicity, they're in Syria, they're in northern Iraq, they're in parts of Turkey, they're in parts of Iran. So how many Kurds are there, actually?
And they're fragmented. You know, politically and socially, Iraqi Kurds are far different than Kurds that you see in northeast Syria and the Kurds that you see in southern Turkey. And so, you know, there was a huge, I guess if you want to call it a miscalculation, there was a miscalculation that was made. But we're hoping that when the parliament resumes, I believe either tomorrow or the following day, that we'll start to see some type of agreement between the KRG and Baghdad, and one that benefits the minorities, because the minorities have been caught in the crossfire in Iraq and in places like Syria for a number of decades. And so, that's our hope at this point. In terms
now,
of
the parliament you're referring to is the Iraqi parliament, right? Central government.
Right. They determine the budget. They determine how much, the KRG will receive in terms of salaries for employees and members of the army and things like that. So we hope to get a better look at the situation after the parliament resumes.
So again, about what was it been about 2 months ago now, about 8 weeks ago, the Kurdish folks were declaring independence. What happened with that referendum or initiative? Where does that stand at this point?
For the most part, it's been struck down. It was probably a miscalculation made by Barzani. He may have thought that he would have received more support from places like Great Britain and the United States. But ultimately, the State Department stuck with their not just their talking point, but their belief that they believe that Iraq should remain unified.
And this goes all the way back post World War I, because at that time the British government could have carved out a place for the Kurds at that time, but did not.
Right,
and so this is a problem that has been decades old, And the Kurds are, you know, they're somewhat in limbo, as the Chaldean Christians in northern Iraq are somewhat in limbo.
Because as we know, you know, during World War II, there were several promises that were made by the British to, you know, some of these groups in the Middle East. And it wasn't just the Kurds. You know, the Assyrians were given the very same promise, which is what Chaldean Christians fall under in terms of ethnicity. So, you know, that plays a role still today in places like Iraq, Syria, and these other diverse countries in the Middle East, where, you know, ethnicity and religion plays a very strong role in the social construct of the people. And that contributes to the uneasy tension and the unrest that we've seen dating back to World War II.
So going forward, who is the leader in Iraq right now? Excuse my ignorance.
Haider al-Abadi.
When was he elected?
So he took over for Maliki in late 2014.
So how would you rate him next to Maliki? Now, I wasn't a fan of Maliki. I didn't really care for him too much. I felt that he had so much, you know, like a puppet of the Iranian government. Well, how do you rate the new leader?
Well, you know, I'll be fair, and I'll say that he's exceeded my expectations. He came from the same party as Maliki, the Dawa Party,
right?
And, so there was a lot of questions revolving around that. And not only that, Maliki maintained his status under the administration, if you will, as a vice president. However, Abadi has persevered. He's been extremely resilient. He's been able to maintain control. He has the religious leaders allied with him, which is very important, Sistani and the like. He's proven far beyond my expectations. Going forward, the most important thing here is that Iraq does not fall under the, you know, with the same mistakes that they made post 2006, post 2007, or post 2003, if you will, which is, you know, encouraging these sectarian militias and an ethnic cleanse in these large cities like Baghdad. They need to be more welcoming and police forces of specific tribes and specific areas need to be given more power. So Christian militias, for example, because our people at this point will only trust our people to defend them, and vice versa with other ethnic communities there. So we're hoping that these sectarian divisions will begin to wane down, and that the country as a whole will be more welcoming of its minorities and those that have struggled for several decades.
Well, again, this is somewhat encouraging. We're speaking with Nathan Colasso from the Chaldean community of Greater Detroit. We're going to talk about the special school that he actually runs in Greater Detroit. And also, I have some thoughts about the various players of these militias and how that is going to play out. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back on the other side. Don't go away.
Who's looking out for seniors today? It's not the AARP. AARP worked overtime to help pass Obamacare, the legislation that cut over $700 billion from Medicare. And AARP supports the death tax, which can rob families of over half their savings due to the death of a loved one. Seniors know that AARP would rather make millions peddling insurance products than support the policies that actually help America's elderly. That's why America's seniors count on the 60 Plus Association. For more than 20 years, 60 Plus has been fighting for the seniors that AARP has left behind. 60 Plus fought against Obamacare and continues to fight every day for its repeal in Washington. And 60 Plus is the leading national organization working to repeal the death tax once and for all, so that families can pass down their businesses and farms to the next generation, not the IRS. Stand up for your values. Join 60 Plus today. Visit 60plus.org or call 703-807-2070. This message paid for and authorized by the 60 Plus Association.
Okay, and we're back with Nathan Colasso of the Greater Chaldean Community of Greater Detroit. Nathan, talk to us about the school that you run in Greater Detroit? Because it is a specialized school of those who are immigrating to the United States. And, of course, a lot of these immigrants are from various places. And, of course, the children have had various levels of education. And your school is somewhat specialized because some of these kids may have been refugee camps. They may have been displaced because of war or turmoil or religious persecution. Tell us a little bit about the school, the academy.
Sure. So 85% of our student population are immigrants, and more specific than that, refugee immigrants. And about 60% of the school are Chaldean Assyrian Christians who have come from places like Iraq and Syria. So these children have been without formal education for a number of years. And in addition to that, they've lived in refugee camps or resettled areas for the most part since they were very young. So our focus is on providing a number of services for them to accommodate the barriers that they have when they first arrive to the United States. That includes English classes for parents. That includes behavioral health and legal services for them. It also includes translations, and we also provide a primary health clinic for the children for free, so that if they're ever sick, rather than going to a doctor that may live far away, they can just attend a nurse practitioner in our building. So we started to see a lot of success. We've since expanded, so there's three locations now. You know, we're hoping that in addition to the students that we have, the ones in the future that come from Iraq and the greater Middle East, if they do land in Detroit, are able to make it into our doors, because we believe that we are able to accommodate them more efficiently and more effectively than other institutions in the area.
You have three locations now.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Well, congratulations on that. That's awesome.
I keep telling you to make it out here, Chris. You got to come visit.
I am coming. Here shortly in the new year. Absolutely. It's been on my mind. Well, let's head back to Iraq and let's talk a little bit about, obviously, it was a multinational force that was pushing out ISIS. It was obviously elements of the Iraqi army, but also there was Shiite folks that were backed by Iran. Explain to us a little bit about that militia group that causes you some concern going forward.
Yeah, so this is the same militia force that we saw sort of take the wheel in the late 2000s. And they're called the Hashd al-Shaabi. And although there are different groups of it now, they're still very divided under sectarian lines. And so the biggest concern that we have are these Shia militia groups, in particular the Hashd al-Shaabi, that are still controlling checkpoints in the Nineveh Plain in areas that are predominantly Assyrian Christian or Chaldean Christian. We've already started to see problems that have begun to arise between those militia groups and the other subset militia groups, like the NPU, which is the Nineveh Plain Protection Unit, which is mainly comprised of Christians. So our hope is that Haider al-Abadi either defunds this group, or that he at least moves them away from the Nineveh Plain area, so that we don't start to see the same type of violence creeping in that we saw post 2006 and 2007.
That's right.
Yeah.
Does the Chaldean Christian community have representation in Parliament?
Yeah, they have representation not only in the Parliament in Baghdad, but also within the KRG. However, it's very small. At this point, we're less than 1% of the population in the country. So it's difficult to maintain influence when you're such a small minority. As I've mentioned previously, Abadi has proven himself to overcome a lot of this
this unrest, and he's been very welcoming to several of the communities there. We're just hoping that rather than lighting up a Christmas tree, for Christians on Christmas, you know, we start to see more freedoms and we start to see the country being, more reformed and welcoming to not just Christians, but other minorities like the Yazidis and whatnot.
That's right. And it's been such a long struggle from the time in which ISIS invaded. Actually, in the aftermath of the Iraqi war, and then when the ISIS terror army invaded and announced the caliphate and the persecution of Christians. And Nathan, our hearts and thoughts have always been with you in the community, and we've prayed through, we've seen some positive things that have developed, but there's so much more to do, and that's why I'm so glad you've joined me on the program today. There is some hope with the new appointment of the new Religious Liberty Ambassador, Sam Brownback. We hope to get him connected with you, and I think that you could give him more of a briefing than just about anybody I know as to what's happening to the Christian minority in northern Iraq.
Absolutely. Thanks again for having me, Chris. I really appreciate that.
Well, you're welcome, my friend, and we'll have you back on, and I'll be up to see you soon. We'll make arrangements. I'd love to visit with you and the folks up there in Detroit. God bless you, my friend. Again, that's Nathan Colasso, who is the director of the Keys Grace Academy in Greater Detroit, a specialized school for those refugees coming in to and immigration to the United States. If you've missed any of our program, you can always catch it on our website at ohioca.org. God bless and good night.
You have been listening to News in Focus with your host, Chris Long, president of the Ohio Christian Alliance. To learn more about the issues that matter most to you and your family, visit online at ohioca.org. That's ohioca.org. Thank you for listening. This program is sponsored by the Ohio Christian Alliance of Akron, Ohio.